Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. While the world deals with an ongoing and escalating refugee crisis, the USA is shutting its door on seven countries. Already, state and local governments are seeking ways to challenge the new administration's orders. We'll explore the historic, global, and legal context with our experts. But first, how is international law changing for human rights and for war? Says our next guest, moving from protecting states security to increasingly protecting individual security. These shifts are influenced by the human rights frame and reshaping the scope of what she calls humanity's law. Ruti Tytel joins us now. She is professor of law at New York University and author of Transitional Justice and her latest, Humanity's Law. Welcome, Ruti Tytel. Let's start with the fundamental concepts of your book, Humanity's Law. The idea that international law, the laws of war, the laws of peace, human rights law, is evolving. Give us a little bit of historic background of how we've come to where we are today, starting with, say, the Geneva Conventions, the UN Charter.
My book tells the story of how there is now a framework that connects up the law of war, international human rights law, and the new enforcement through international criminal justice. And I argue that this has come about in order to really fill in the gaps given the rise of different kind of conflict today and globalization. Just tracing this history, you could say part of it started at the end of World War II with the rise of human rights law, but you also have a long-standing kind of evolution in the law of war, and you mentioned the Geneva Conventions. These have evolved over time, obviously based on older conventions, the Hague Convention and so on. We're really seeing a revival of a much older set of norms that go back to the just war tradition, and that what we had in the modern state, the kind of conventions and the regulation that people were concerned with for the last 200 years really hasn't been enough, because it really is premised on state sovereigns controlling their own citizens, and that what we are seeing today is a revival of a much older tradition that goes back to Hugo Grotius and the view that there are certain interventions that are just. And that's really a major shift in both law and in conflict today.
We've got a lot of different developments that deal with non-state actors, and as you mentioned, a different kind of conflict. Talk about what some of these things are that you see as contributing to the need to change the approach.
There are new threats. You could say there's certainly the old one, interstate conflict, but today we also see that most conflict is internal, including civil war, genocide, and other large-scale atrocities. If you add transnational organized crime, terrorism, and then also nuclear, radiological, chemical, and biological weapons, and then lastly, economic and social threats, poverty, infectious diseases, environmental degradation. What this means is that most of the threats and vulnerabilities today are internal to states, and you're talking about a world that is highly connected and interdependent without world government, without political integration. So that spells out really the kind of gaps we see today that result in the possibility of large numbers of casualties due to civil wars and other kinds of conflict that we've seen in recent years. If you think about the breakup of the former Yugoslavia or the genocide in Rwanda.
You said it's hard to say when we're at war or when we're at peace. And these kinds of confusing situations, because of these changes in interstate, intrastate relations and conflicts, have been something new that we're dealing with. And so you're seeing kind of this overlap in the laws even of war and laws of peace. How were they distinguished and how are they emerging today?
In the past, the law of war was generally associated with constraints on the waging of war, and particularly international conflict. You know, the Geneva Conventions have evolved since the end of World War II to include some internal conflict and really to try to address issues of decolonization and self-determination. But for the most part, the law of war addressed interstate conflict. That was really the traditional view, is that it's really about protecting state borders and the sovereignty of states. So today, the shift is that we need more and more to fill in this gap of conflict that is internal and ethnic, this kind of ethnic persecution that now goes by the name ethnic cleansing. And so judges and other lawmakers have articulated this problem of this gap in legal protection. That's one set of developments. And then coming from the other side, from international human rights law, that was a set of norms that was associated with peacetime and really always thought of as claims that are made vis-a-vis the state. But today we see that there are a variety of scenarios where, as you pointed out, conflict is murky. If you think about the former Soviet Union, the Islamic frontier in the Soviet Union, there have been rulings in the European Court of Human Rights that apply both human rights law and the law of conflict out of a concern to protect life as much as possible in those conflicts. And there are other scenarios we've seen, for example, in the former Yugoslavia, where some of the conflict was internal and some of it was international. And the courts are saying that from a citizen's perspective, what difference does it make? Can't be that protection will only apply if the conflict is fully international. And I would add one other piece, and that is the enforcement strand, which now is really depending more and more on international criminal law and tribunals. And that's because this has all become individualized. And that's another way that we see the move away from the state and the protection of state sovereignty.
You also mentioned that these non-state actors, like the militias, are also being held responsible. In fact, you talk about rights and then you talk about responsibilities all becoming kind of individualized. Give us an example of these legal responsibilities that are being expanded.
So some of the examples where really this has been, you know, subject of rulings in the Balkans, a number of the actors that really were responsible for the most heinous atrocities were paramilitary actors. They weren't political leaders. And in fact, the first case before the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia is the case of Duško Tadić, who is found on the run in Germany. And he was paramilitary, but was responsible for terrible crimes against humanity in the Omarska detention camp. They called it a concentration camp. And so that's one example where he's held to account in this tribunal, where it really the kinds of crimes that he's convicted of were crimes that were thought to be crimes associated really with state leaders. There are other examples where state actors are held responsible even for omission to protect, including some level of responsibility for non-state actors. And we've seen that, for example, in Latin America, in part of the quote-unquote terror war, where Fujimori and some of his, if you will, paramilitary actors were, you know, where the state was held responsible for some of those actions in the quote-unquote war against terror in Peru, so counter-terror measures. So those are two aspects where you have an expansion of enforcement. On the one hand, the individual enforcement against a non-state actor, but on the other, states are also more responsible now. They, too, have to develop capacities and are being held responsible for actions taken by non-state actors.
You also note that this new shape of humanities law has become justification for intervention, which can sometimes also be harmful.
That's true. And my book, it's really seeking to explain the kinds of war we're seeing, the kinds of global engagements we've been seeing over the last 10, 15 years leading up, and I think it's a great example of the intervention in Libya. In the past, again, when people talked about the law of war, they were largely talking about constraints on the waging of war. My framework goes back to an earlier pre-modern international law and observes that what we're seeing today is the invocation of norms of preservation, going back to Hobbes and other thinkers, and that preservation is the most important, and that this is being used as a justification, and that it really is a justification for military intervention today. So I would say Libya, the actions taken at the Security Council to intervene in what was an internal conflict in Libya, are a really good illustration of the way this kind of framework is affecting political actors today.
Perhaps if we look back a little bit further, we also see the bombing of Kosovo.
That's right. The bombing of Kosovo, I would say, predates some of the most recent legal developments, was known as an example where many saw it as a justified intervention, given the atrocities and the failure of the state to be able to protect certainly some of its ethnic peoples. But it was known as illegal but legitimate. I would say today, given what we saw in the Security Council, the intervention in Libya, no one's saying it's illegal. People might differ on the legitimacy question, but you had a rare authorization at the Security Council that was justified explicitly in terms of the protection of civilians. And we really haven't seen that ever before.
So if we were going to look at the developments that are coming now, we have major global changes, and it seems like it will potentially further this idea of individualization of international law. We've got mass migration, climate change, but globalization economically. How would you say humanity's law is becoming intertwined with these developments?
Clearly, we can see that it's case by case, and that the claim for protection may well exceed, the normativity may well exceed the current possibility of delivery. It's kind of like a substance process divide right now. And it needs to be case by case, because there are instances where there may well be an important claim for protection, but it may well not be feasible if it only can be done with aerial bombing. As we saw the example of Afghanistan, this could result in too many lives being lost. Certainly, the argument clearly seemed off in Iraq. Now, when you're talking about globalization, obviously, there are a number of different threats that affect persons and peoples, so we could discuss that. I don't know if you're talking about economic security primarily or economic threats as the next, what humanity's law would have to say about that.
Across the globe, seeing these matters that affect all people in an interconnected way, whether it is the mass migration, which is really blurring borders considerably. And when we look at climate change, how it affects so many people of so many different states, and then the economic sort of intertwining that has gone on with globalization, immigration could be seen as a globalization issue as well. And there are a lot of human rights issues that are tied up in that also.
And I would say that certainly with respect to the economic question, there are going to be issues of how much can be addressed by outside states and by the international community. But I think right now what we're seeing is the articulation of the values of the normativity and a clear recognition that the problems today, the gaps, they don't know the limit of state borders. They're not defined by state borders, these threats. And so the old interstate security framework, as reflected by the UN and the Security Council, if it just follows the post-World War II framework, it just can't really deal with the problems today. Now, can one protect civilians all over the globe from all of these potential threats? This is really an important question today, and clearly one that is being raised in many forms. What we're seeing today, for example, in Europe, the kind of economic issues, the massive unemployment, the challenges to the social welfare state that they'd had, obviously they were better off than many parts of the globe, but it's an interesting illustration of the kind of regional help that the way society and European society is being redefined over this threat, and leading some to say that perhaps it takes threats to redefine the parameters of international society.
This idea of undermining state sovereignty in favor of protecting the individual, it seems like that started to occur a while back, even with the, say, establishment of the European Court of Human Rights, and that institution trying to surpass the idea of the state. Would you say that it goes back that far?
Certainly there were trends, but what I'm identifying is not necessarily the diminishment of state sovereignty, but rather the relativization of it. In many of these instances, as we've been discussing, it's calling for intervention, calling for greater capacity on the part of states in order to be able to protect civilians on a transnational basis and to rise to the challenge of some of these threats. In some instances, the state itself has this greater duty to protect, you know, has been now recognized since 2000. 2005 at the UN with this language of the quote-unquote responsibility to protect. It's a duty to intervene. So this is very different than the kind of human rights raised just internally vis-a-vis the state. This is just a different order, a different paradigm. And so in the first instance, it's the state's duty to do that. And then the next question is, well, what happens when states fail to do so? And we saw that that duty to protect was really the basis for a coalition to intervene in Libya. It's not just a limiting of states, but rather it has become a new basis for global engagement.
Well, that's a perfect place to end. Ruti Tytel is with us. Her book is called Humanity's Law. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, while the world deals with an ongoing and escalating refugee crisis, the USA is shutting its door on 7 countries. We'll explore the historic, global, and legal context with our experts. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. While the world deals with an ongoing and escalating refugee crisis, the USA is shutting its door on 7 countries. Already, state and local governments are seeking ways to challenge the new administration's orders. We'll explore the historic, global, and legal context with our experts. Kevin Johnson is Dean of the School of Law and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at the University of California, Davis. He has authored Opening the Floodgates: Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws. He's also authored Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. David Kyle is professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migrations, Networks, and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador. Phil Orchard is senior lecturer in Peace and Conflict Studies and International Relations. He's the research director of the Asia-Pacific Center for Responsibility to Protect at the University of Queensland in Australia. He's the author of A Right to Flee, Refugees, States, and the Construction of International Cooperation in the forthcoming book, Protecting the Internally Displaced, Rhetoric and Reality. Brad Blitz is professor of international politics at Middlesex University in London. He's the author of European Union, Displaced, Undocumented, and Unwanted, Statelessness in Citizenship, a Comparative Study on the Benefits of Nationality, and Migration and Freedom, Mobility, Citizenship, Exclusion. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Great to have you all with us once again. I thought we should start with this nexus between refugees, migrants, immigration. What are the common cross-sections? Phil Orchard?
Certainly. Basically, what we're seeing is that we've got a lot of people who are refugees under what's called the 1951 Refugee Convention, which defines their status. But we also have a lot of people who have been displaced internally in places like Syria. They remain within their own country, but they've still been displaced. And we also have other people who are forced migrants who don't fall within the Refugee Convention's definition, which is relatively restrictive.
Do we have a sense of what percent is what in the migration? Like what percent are asylum seekers, refugees, and forced migrants?
Basically, in terms of the overall figures, we're looking at about 60 million. About over two-thirds of those are internally displaced persons. So the vast majority of current forced migrants remain within their own countries. In addition, then, we have refugees, and we have refugees under 2 different organizations, which always complicates the math. The bulk of them are under the UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, but there's also a group who are Palestinians who are under the auspices of the UNRWA, or Relief Works Agency. In addition, we know that there's a larger number of forced migrants who don't fall within the refugee status. And UNHCR today frequently refers to them as people of concern, people who are facing potentially persecution that doesn't fall within the convention, or situations of generalized violence that they've had to flee from, but that don't fit within that definition.
Brad Blitz, what would you add to that?
Well, I think that for many states, it's often difficult to understand the differences between these categories of people. And it's important to recognize that everyone has human rights, and whether someone falls within the Refugee Convention or not, their rights need to be respected. And that's really a major challenge these days, especially when you raise the question around immigration, because often people may be considered unlawful or irregular migrants when, in fact, under other circumstances, their claims would be recognized and they might, in fact, qualify as refugees.
So what would be an example of that?
To give you an example, I am speaking to you now from Athens, where I have been going around refugee centers. And I've been speaking to refugee protection agencies. And we know that there is a large number of Afghans here. These are Afghans that are contained now in camps, centers. They have crossed the Aegean alongside Syrians and others. And the Greek government and other governments don't necessarily know whether or not they would be considered refugees and entitled to refugee status, or whether or not they may be considered economic migrants. They say, well, it depends on which part of Afghanistan they've come from, what sort of conditions were they facing when they left, were they motivated on the grounds of persecution. Now, Afghanistan is an extremely unstable country and persecution is rife. And I think at other times, one wouldn't ask quite so many questions about these people's status. But that is the situation we're in now.
Kevin Johnson.
Well, in the United States, I think that the largest group of migrants are immigrants, and we admit about a million a year into the United States. We also have a refugee admissions program, which involves overseas refugee admissions, and that's usually in the 100,000, 200,000, 250,000 per year range. And then we have what are called asylum seekers, people who come here from other countries. And once they're here, they apply for asylum because of feared persecution. And then we also have a fairly significant unauthorized immigrant population of probably in the neighborhood of 11 million undocumented immigrants who live in the country. I do think it's hard to draw lines between economic migrants and political refugees in certain circumstances. And historically, the United States has had a difficult time sort of separating out those two categories. You know, we can think about Haitian persons coming to the United States in the 80s and 90s, and whether they're political refugees fleeing political violence or whether they're economic migrants fleeing utter poverty. More recently, you can see that with respect, that difficulty in discerning whether Central Americans are bona fide refugees or whether they're economic migrants. But we have a continuing problem fitting people in the different categories in the United States.
David Kyle, that brings us to your work, too, because you've talked about all the different factors, the economic systems, the global recession. How would you lay this out?
I think that if we're looking at the intersection or the overlap across these groups, is that it's even kind of muddier than that, and yet very concrete, in that you could have the same group that's being It's hiring smugglers across the border. And by definition, if you're a persecuted group, that means that your travel within a country is not exactly easy all the time. And yet we recognize that there is a need to leave. And so in the same group that might be hiring smugglers, you might have what we may call economic migrants. But also in that group, we might have trafficking victims that are being coerced or tricked. And this is just one stop along the way that they don't know what they're in for. But we also may have potential asylum seekers who are seeking things like freedom to pursue their lifestyle choices or who they are, their religion, and a number of categories that are persecuted in their home country. And it becomes both overlapping and very difficult to tell just by looking at them. And only after they go through the system can we tell, you know, where they might end up. They often check multiple boxes, though.
You know, you had written in your book about impossible choices that a lot of them face. First of all, what were the impossible choices that you wrote about at the time, but do you think they've changed?
Unfortunately, I think that there are just fewer choices for many people, impossible or not. So we might want to reframe it as just have kind of lacking choices. But often the impossible choices are, it's sort of between a rock and a hard place. Either we leave here, it's something that's untenable, and even though it's of great risk and mixed messages quite often in terms of whether there will be a destination that will be accepting or not, or we stay and with the belief that nothing really will change and it might even get worse. And that is often the situation that many would-be migrants, not just refugees, find themselves in.
Phil Orchard, let's bring you back to talk about the trends that you've seen change. Last time we had you on, it was 2 years ago. I wrote down 59 million refugees at the time. What shifts have we seen and what's happened since then?
Well, what we've seen is, of course, a steady growth in refugee numbers and internally displaced person numbers over the past few years. And this is primarily being driven by Syria. And I think just to echo David's point, you know, when you look at the situation in Syria, we're looking at over 5 million refugees outside of the country, but we're also looking at over 6 million internally displaced persons, as I mentioned earlier. And what we're seeing in Syria is a pattern of repeated flight. So frequently people are fleeing within Syria one, two, or many times, and only then they're actually choosing to then leave the country. And further, once they're outside of Syria itself and when they're in the region, you're looking at countries, Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan, particularly, where they're not full signatories to the Refugee Convention. And they're also increasingly running into assistance problems. So the WFP, the World Food Program, just announced last week that it was actually having to cut the rations once again that it was providing to refugees. Further, because they don't have full rights within those situations, because they're not protected under the Refugee Convention, a lot of them are moving onwards. And that's why we've seen this steady movement into Europe. And the thing is, a lot of these refugees, they want to return home. I'm just working on a paper with a colleague where we've been using survey data, looking at interviews from Syrian refugees. And primarily what they're talking about is they're talking about the violence they themselves or their families have experienced. And a lot of them are pointing to the idea that they'll return on either one of two factors. One is that a lot of them, particularly the highly educated refugees, only want to return if they see Assad removed, if they see some form of democracy introduced. The bulk of refugees themselves, they don't actually even want that. They just want stability. They don't want to be hit by barrel bombs. They want to know that they can have safe lives in the country.
So I wonder if we could turn now to what we're seeing happening in the policies, particularly coming out of the United States with Trump's executive orders. Brad Blitz, perhaps we should bring you in on this. You've done some writing on this. What is going to be the global effect of Donald Trump's policies?
I think the effects are, in the first instance, going to be felt by those that would otherwise qualify for refugee resettlement and their families. And we should add that the executive order covers both refugees and it covers green card holders. So it's an attack on both the immigration system and the refugee system. Now, the other countries that are supporting refugees have already been alerted to the fact that if you take out tens of thousands of people from the U.S. resettlement program, this is going to place an additional burden, certainly a moral responsibility on them. And that's what we heard from David Miliband, who is the director of the International Rescue Committee. That is that Europe, Western Europe in particular, is going to be leaned on to take more refugees.
Kevin Johnson, you've looked at the long history of U.S. policy on these issues. How different is Donald Trump's policy from, say, the previous administration? Is it drastically different?
In some ways, President Trump's policy isn't that different than President Obama's policies. In some ways, they're radically different. For example, the similarities are this. In his first two executive orders on immigration, President Trump is really trying to build on the crime-based removal system that was perfected in certain respects by President Obama. And he's trying to expand those systems and increase the number of non-citizens removed from the country every year, expanding the scope of crimes that you can be arrested for and subject you to removal. And President Obama set removal records in his first term. And I think that President Trump is going to try to rival those records. So they're similar in some ways. They're very different when it comes to the executive order issued last Friday, where there's a suspension of the visas to non-citizens from seven different nations all predominantly populated by Muslims. And I think that's something that, you know, President Obama has already criticized publicly. In suspending, actually, the other thing that's very different is President Trump suspended the refugee admissions program for 4 months. I don't recall that happening, at least since the Refugee Act of 1980 was passed, and we've had sort of an overseas refugee admissions program. So in this way, President Trump is very different from President Obama. So I do think that there's some similarities and differences. I do think the harshness of President Trump's policies with respect to immigrants, temporary visitors, and asylum seekers and refugees is a good deal harsher in tone and impact than President Obama's.
We have a number of groups that are filing lawsuits to try to block this policy. So we know that there have been some ACLU types of lawsuits already. We've got some judgments on that. But now the state of Washington, the city of San Francisco, having looked at the legal decisions and debates, how do you suspect these are going to pan out?
I think there's a wide variety of different issues. I mean, there's individual habeas corpus actions being brought, and that's a very independent individual case. And you have nationwide class actions that are seeking injunctions of the entire policy, and there are different policies being challenged. The San Francisco lawsuit challenges a defunding effort in one of the executive orders of sanctuary cities. The state of Washington and ACLU in another lawsuit are challenging the suspension of admissions from those seven nations that I mentioned. I think in the end, some of these issues are very likely to make their way to the United States Supreme Court, particularly the one from last Friday that targets people from one of the seven nations. That's, I don't want to say it's unheard of in American history, but it's not something we see very often. And we haven't seen in many years an entire, admission bar to new admittees from certain countries. We've seen some special registration requirements for people from the Middle East, but we haven't seen this kind of blanket denial of admission. So I think that particular issue in one of the cases, and it's challenged in the state of Washington lawsuit, but it's also challenged in the ACLU lawsuit, and it's also challenged in a lawsuit brought on behalf of American Muslims. Those all could make their way to the United States Supreme Court and chart sort of a new path for our constitutional law with respect to how we treat immigrants and refugees.
David Kahle, I wonder if we could bring you in on this, too, in terms of the role of sanctuary cities and how this is panning out. How do you see this?
I think of this as in broader economic historical terms, and that we have the challenge of soft power and hard reality, as I see it. It's been since 1965 and the change of immigration laws at that time that one of the tenets in Wisconsin law is that we don't discriminate by nationality. Prior to that, in the midst of the civil rights movement, in the midst of a Cold War, we felt that to project our soft power, winning the hearts and minds of people, it was very necessary that we did away with those national quotas and systems that really took off the table most of Latin America and Asia. We're really kind of turning the clock back then, and that's going to be an interesting challenge for the United States. I think more importantly, the hard reality of globalization, we're about to find out how much of a reality that really was when globalization was framed in the 90s as it really became a zeitgeist. It was framed as the natural order of things and that you couldn't do anything about this reality. And I think that building things like walls, apart from the change in the laws, I think the wall is the symbol here. Is that, are we going to go back to Fortress America, literally build a wall and really signal to the rest of the world that globalization is dead, as well as renegotiating not just the details of a NAFTA or other economic policies with Mexico, but our entire historical relationship with that country? And I think we're about to find out, regardless of facts or alternative facts, what is the hard reality of globalization? I think that that's related to the sanctuary cities and how people feel emboldened and empowered to just spontaneously rise up and protect their cities and the people that live in them.
Brad Blitz, you've also looked at this historically, except for with regards to some of the European concerns from World War II and such. How would you characterize these parallels?
I think there's actually a much greater line of continuity. It's not just since World War II. I think many people have commented on the use of this executive order to target particular nationalities. And here we are talking about Syrians. It's not just like what we saw in the 1930s where Jews were targeted under Nazi laws. There are a number of countries that have historically over time both denationalized foreign-born citizens, but also they have stripped away the rights of residents in those countries. And in that sense, I think that this executive order or these executive orders really position the United States in or alongside a really very dark period of history, because those orders were discriminatory. And when we think of the expulsions, for example, the expulsions of ethnic Turks from Bulgaria, or we think of even more recent expulsions of ethnic Haitians and the descendants of ethnic Haitians from the Dominican Republic, is the sort of image that we want to see of the United States.
I wonder if we could touch briefly on what the options are for people who are still trying to figure out where they can be, where they can call home, what their conditions are until they do figure out what their options are. Do you have a sense of that, Brad Blitz?
Right now, the information that people are receiving is quite confused. Certainly, I have heard from a number of people in Europe that they've greeted the so-called exemptions positively. They say, oh, well, this shouldn't affect dual nationals from our country or those, for example, that hold British and, say, Iranian passports. But in practice, that's not the case. We see mass confusion at U.S. airports. We see mass confusion among those who are in transit. And I think I would argue that one needs to look at this really cautiously. And there are no guarantees here. There are absolutely no guarantees. And unfortunately, the foreign secretaries and the statements that have been put out by various European representatives, unfortunately, to my mind, they really do not offer the sort of protection that people need, the sort of guarantees that people need when they're in transit.
Phil Orchard, what are people facing? What are they dealing with? What are their options?
Well, we know from the order itself, it appears to have directly affected already about 20,000 refugees who are preparing for resettlement to the United States. Now, it was announced yesterday that about 800 refugees who were already in transit would be allowed in. Now, some of these very same people had already been stopped or even deported out of the U.S. in the couple days after the executive order was introduced. So at least those 800 or so will be let in. But the broader 20,000 are really stuck now because they had gone through all the processes. And it's important to note, President Trump's argued that this order is all about extreme vetting. And the simple fact is the U.S. system was already extreme vetting, that these refugees who were being resettled had already been through a process that usually took 18 months to 2 years. It had seen them provide tons of information to a range of government agencies. It had seen them personally be interviewed by Department of Homeland Security officers. This is the hardest single route to get into the United States. And so what we're seeing is 20,000 refugees who have been through this process, who effectively were just waiting to resettle into the United States, who are now being blocked. We've also seen some stories where people had begun making the move and they've now had to be returned to their original refugee camps. And they've given up everything because they expect to be resettled. They've given up their tents, their possessions that they weren't taking with them and so on. And so now they basically have to get those things back or get new tents. And they sort of, they're immediately at the start of the queue again, which is really problematic for them. So there are a lot of issues associated with the way the order is being played out.
David Kyle.
I think that until the dust settles in the next couple of weeks, it's going to be very hard to offer any concrete advice, at least on my part, as I see it. I think that the routes that are already in place have to be honored and respected for now. And I would assume that people should not change their plans in general based on what's happening in the United States just yet. But obviously, lots of things are changing very quickly here, and I don't think anyone knows the answer right now.
I think that brings us to the detention and deportation detention centers. Kevin Johnson, this has been something that you've been looking at. Do we have a sense about Trump's plans for the detention and deportation?
One of the executive orders, actually, one of the first of two focuses on detention, and immigrant detention is a tool of immigration enforcement. And during the campaign, he emphasized that he would try to eliminate what he referred to as catch and release of immigrants who are arrested and apprehended while they're awaiting their deportation. And he has promised, and actually one of the executive orders the building of more detention centers along the U.S.-Mexico border. And we are expecting to see, we haven't quite seen it yet, increases in detention. And this is an increase that builds on detention records set by President Obama during his administration. So there's a great deal of concern, particularly among certain communities, about what this just might mean in terms of what the administration is going to do. I think that President Obama increased the detention of unaccompanied minors and, you know, families along the U.S.-Mexico border region. And the fear is that this is going to be built on and expanded. And part of the detention may well be done through private contractors, which some would say are less hospitable to non-citizens in custody. So there's a fear that there's going to be more detention. It's going to be more miserable detention. And in fact, that some people might just throw in the towel and agree to removal as opposed to fighting their asylum claims in immigration court.
You know, in one of the pieces that I read from your, can't remember if it was an interview or if it was one of your articles, was talking about the racial element of the deportation. I think it was you that called it Latino removal. So would it be fair now to call it Latino and Muslim removal?
The truth of the matter is, I would say no, because in the United States, the way the immigration system operates, it's closely related to the criminal justice system. And we have sort of racial disparities, particularly directed at Latinos in the criminal justice system in the United States. And it leads to the fact that about 95% of the people every year who are removed from the United States are Latino. Now, there are some much smaller groups of Muslims who are affected, and they are sort of the other group that's been targeted by President Trump. But the numbers are a lot smaller. And so I do think that the special procedures are being put into place, special targeting of visa applicants from particular nations are in place. But I don't think the numbers are the same as it is with respect to immigrants from Mexico or El Salvador and Guatemala combined.
Before we turn to solutions, which I'd like to talk about in just a second, I wanted to also get a sense about Jeff Sessions and what we know about him that might inform where this may end up going. Kevin Johnson.
Jeff Sessions, if you look at his Senate website, takes a very hard line on immigration, and he champions protecting American workers by deporting immigrant workers, particularly undocumented immigrants. And he's championed in the state of Alabama, it wasn't a federal law, but it was a state law, HB 56, that was one of those state immigration enforcement laws that was designed to require state and local law enforcement to inquire into the immigration status of people they had come into contact with. That law was struck down by the federal courts. It never went into impact. Most of it never went into impact. But it gives you a sense of the kind of immigration policies he would have. As Attorney General, he would be the person ultimately in charge of the immigration courts in the United States. Those are the courts that allow for providing relief to immigrants or removing them from the country. It's been a court system that's been greatly overworked with huge caseloads, and also there's been a concern with the quality of the decisions made by those courts. And so there's a great deal of concern among immigrants' rights advocates that will have a sort of a set of policies that are tough on immigrants, that will be very enforcement-oriented, and also that he'll oversee an immigration court system that's focused on removal. Right now, there's a draft floating around of another Trump executive order that would tighten up on temporary worker programs. And this is something that Jeff Sessions has championed. And Jeff Sessions has emphasized that he thinks that the folks in Silicon Valley, they're wanting to bring in temporary workers, really are hurting American workers. And he wants to end some of those temporary worker programs. So I think that That's sort of the short of it, at least. There's also concern about whether the Civil Rights Division that's housed in the Department of Justice, which is led by the Attorney General, will aggressively enforce civil rights actions, including those involving immigrants, under a Jeff Sessions Attorney General tenure. So there's a great deal of concerns.
David Kyle, would you agree?
Yes, I would agree. I think that firing the Attorney General signals kind of the way forward here. I think that whatever Jeff Sessions' history is on this, I think the wider vision that we have of the Trump administration is that this is not just about the details of the policy. It's about signaling domestically and internationally, this is how we will treat immigrants and refugees.
I wonder if we could turn to solutions in terms of how should we be dealing with this, Phil Orchard?
Well, one of the things we see with the global refugee problem today is that with refugees, UNHCR talks about that they have three durable solutions: voluntary return or repatriation to their own country, local integration in a country that's hosting them, and refugee resettlement to a third country. And that's really where the U.S. has been critical for years. The U.S. accepts by far the most resettled refugees. Over the last couple of years, they'd accepted around 70,000 refugees per year through the resettlement program. Under President Obama, this year they had planned to accept under 10,000. And of course, with the executive order, we see that number drop to 50,000. And that assumes that 50,000 might be reached due to these delays, due to the 120-day block that's been imposed. I suspect that we won't see it get close to 50,000. So right away, what this is doing is removing the vast bulk of one of those durable solutions. And here, you know, this has been an area where the U.S. has had real leadership because very few other programs have active resettlement programs. Canada and Australia accept in around 12 to 13,000 refugees each. They've had special programs around Syrian and Iraqi refugees as well. But the bulk of other countries just don't do very much. The United Kingdom, for example, commits to accept about 1,250 refugees per year, though they accepted more than that in 2015. And so if we're thinking about solutions to this problem, one of the things we need to see is a system that works better to ensure that the bulk of these refugees are either having an option towards resettlement, or if they're remaining within their host countries, that those host countries are receiving adequate support to maintain those refugees and ensure they have protection. And unfortunately, right now, that's not what's happening.
Brad Blitz, he mentioned the UK, so I thought it's a perfect cue for you.
Well, from the European perspective, we have a policy on relocation, which is, it's similar to resettlement, but not quite. It's supposed to be both faster and it's operating also in the sense of a quid pro quo on the basis of the EU-Turkey deal. But we know that there are a number of European countries that have agreed to relocate refugees from Greece and Italy in particular, and to rehouse them and give them opportunities, as you might see with resettlement. But the numbers are still very small. The numbers of people being relocated don't match current targets, and the speed as well it's very, very unlikely that they're going to come anywhere near to matching their targets. So there have been repeated calls that the European Union needs to come together on this. We have a number of states that haven't received any refugees, and a number of states, especially, say, in Central Europe, that are quite hostile to this and hostile to the idea of collective responsibility sharing. So I think that's the first thing. We need to make good on existing promises. At the same time, we have people who are in situations of detention. We have people in camps on the Greek islands where they face extremely inhumane conditions. And I think they need to be sprung from those camps, and they need to be put in altogether more humane conditions. And in that context, I'd also say that Australia has a role in all of this, because we know that Australia set up this process of offshoring. And we have, of course, seen images of the people on Manus Island and Papua New Guinea, where they're being contained and prevented from reaching the shores of Australia. And this is a policy that absolutely needs to be condemned. And that's a policy that needs to be rejected altogether so that other states don't follow this example.
Kevin Johnson, we should bring you back in. Potential solutions to these issues. It seems to me that particularly with the Americas, a lot of it is economic. How do you see it?
I agree with you that migration is largely economic, although there's other things that come into play, including violence, political persecution, and the rest. But at least in my estimation, there's sort of two things that I would emphasize. It does seem that we need to, in, at least in North America, to think about how we can work together in terms of migration and refugee issues, and to work together to make it an efficient and effective system, and a system that we can all honor and live with. Unfortunately, at this point, and I'm not even sure if the presidents of Mexico and the United States are on speaking terms right now. They had a meeting scheduled that got canceled after sort of the initial executive order on expanding the U.S.-Mexico border wall. So unfortunately, we're seeming to move in the wrong direction. But in the long run, it seems important that we have to think about how we can work together as a group of nations to deal with migration flows. In the short term in the United States, I do think that it makes perfect sense for political activity to be organized and to focus on some of these issues. I think what happened over the weekend in the United States was largely a grassroots issue, a grassroots movement, where people were just so upset by what they were seeing our government do that they, you know, participated in all kinds of protests and actually a lot of helping of people at airports across the country, lawyers and others helping people who were caught up in a very uncertain web at this point. I think that if we want positive change in this country, we're going to have to continue to push forward on immigration. It's been that way for a long time. It's going to continue to be that way in the future. And also in the long term, I think we have to focus on sort of regional solutions in how we approach these issues.
Yes, I agree. I think that as long as the political leaders can't talk or develop a rapport, then these other questions of policy and implementation are really second order. It's the more managerial framing of the problem that is already very, very difficult. But under these circumstances, it's hard to kind of see how we even get to that point again. That said, even though it seems like lifetimes ago, we might remember, it's largely forgotten now, that right before 9/11, and on September 6, 2001, Vicente Fox, president of Mexico, was here in the United States visiting with President George W. Bush because they were floating the idea that as part of NAFTA, they would eventually open the border with Mexico and then harden the border with Guatemala. And of course, 9/11 happened just a few days later, and that was completely forgotten. But it just shows you how close we were under a Republican administration, I might add. And that while that may or may not give us cause to hope, it just shows you how quickly things can change in either direction.
Final thoughts, Phil Orchard?
It is very troubling what's happened over the past week. And ideally, what we'll see is through court action, as has been noted, we'll see some real changes happen to the executive order. But I think we also need to see other states step up, as has already been argued, and do more to take in these refugees and to help them.
Brad Blitz?
I would certainly agree with the comments from our colleagues. But one thing I would like to call attention to is the role of effective leadership that we've seen from Canada. In fact, the Canadian behaving in a way which is truly countercultural when one looks at all the really nasty and abusive statements that have come out from politicians around the world. Here we have a leader, we have Justin Trudeau, who has said refugees are welcome, and you know what, I'm going to make good on the promises that you've heard. We're going to increase numbers, and we are going to set a tone here, which is truly antithetical to what we're hearing just south of the border.
Kevin Johnson.
I don't think that the Trump people have much of a set of contacts with Canada. We certainly don't seem to be following their policies very much. And it's quite frustrating that we often, as a nation, view ourselves as a nation alone and go out on our own when it comes to migration issues. And I think that's deeply, deeply unfortunate. I do think that it's important to remember that, at least in this country, and I think worldwide in certain respects, these movements, these tensions, these views of immigrants, they've gone up and down over time. And as David Kyle was mentioning, you know, we could see change. And I think in the long run, we will. But as Keynes also said, in the long run, we're all dead. So I hope sooner as opposed to later that some of these changes get made because, you know, frankly, some of what we're seeing now detention of Central American asylum applicants. It's back to the 1980s when I first got involved in immigration and started studying asylum issues and things like that. It is a frustrating sort of set of circumstances we see, but the politics can change on a dime.
David Kyle.
I think the very thing that is so challenging and difficult about the migration area, the migration phenomena, is that it's politicized, and yet that's also potentially its strength right now, which shows you that politicians, global leaders, industry leaders, et cetera, do respond to political movements. And I believe that we're going to see a backlash in all kinds of areas, some organic, some very organized. And I think that the American population has become so complacent about migrants and in a very complex phenomena. But in a way, this does clear the underbrush and really starkly highlights the issues at hand. There are the humanitarian issues. There are the issues of the social, political, and cultural relationships that we quite often have with migrants and refugees before they come over. And there are the issues of what this means to all of our freedoms to move around the planet, not to mention the legal and other national backlashes against American mobility over time. And I think that that political dimension to migration is also perhaps a cause for hope that it does have an impact and things can change for the better.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Kevin Johnson, David Kyle, Phil Orchard, Brad Blitz. Great pleasure to hear your thoughts and your research. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kevin Johnson is Dean of the School of Law and Professor of Public Interest Law and Chicano Studies at the University of California, Davis. He has authored Opening the Floodgates, Why America Needs to Rethink Its Borders and Immigration Laws. He's also authored Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. David Kyle is Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Davis. His publications include Global Human Smuggling, Comparative Perspectives, and Transnational Peasants, Migrations, Networks, and Ethnicity in Andean Ecuador. Phil Orchard is Senior Lecturer in Peace and Conflict Studies and International Relations. He's the Research Director of the Asia-Pacific Center for Responsibility to Protect at the University of Queensland in Australia. He's the author of A Right to Flee, Refugees, States, and the Construction of International Cooperation in the forthcoming book, Protecting the Internally Displaced, Rhetoric and Reality. Brad Blitz is Professor of International Politics at Middlesex University in London. He's the author of European Union, Displaced, Undocumented, and Unwanted, Statelessness and Citizenship, a Comparative Study on the Benefits of Nationality, and Migration and Freedom, Mobility, Citizenship, Exclusion. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.